Hey folks, this is the Contextual Insurgent Podcast, and I'm your host, Aaron Smith. I'm an activist, an analyst, a writer, and a sensemaker. I'm a Republican, a former SFGOP Central Committee Delegate, where I was the Deputy Vice Chair of Communications. As California GOP-endorsed State Senate candidate, where I managed to win 11% of the vote in San Francisco, which, trust me, is better than average. I've also been involved with the firearms community and Second Amendment rights. I was on the cover of Time magazine in November of 2018 for their Guns in America issue. But I'm probably best known for my free speech activism and facing off with hard lefties like Antifa in California and the Pacific Northwest since 2017. The general topic of this podcast series will be politics in the current culture war, as seen from my unique, rather hands-on experience and knowledge, but also intend to include a practical element focused on giving you the conceptual tools to build towards true grassroots, nonviolent political change. You may have noticed lefties usually seem to get what they want regardless of how elections go, and I want to help you change that. You can also sign up for my Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I have a weekly newsletter that looks back at some of the highlighted stories of the week and gives you some feedback and analysis of what's happening. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/EESmith4. That's the number 4. I also have a Cash App at $EESmith4. Again, that's the number 4. For the cost of a mocha frappuccino once a month, you can support my work, which is ultimately about helping you. Hey everyone, welcome to Daily Dispatch number 13. I hope you're doing pretty awesome today. I'm going to start off here. I want to thank a new patron member, Gary. Gary sent a message after he joined, and he brought up a really interesting idea, and I'm going to kind of spin off of this and riff on some related other topics. But, you know, he talks about, you know, I'm always talking about, you know, you've heard me say before, the ironic thing about individual rights is it requires collective group effort by like-minded people to protect them. And he kind of brought up an interesting point. He wanted to kind of respond to that a little bit, kind of build on it. He calls it something called connectivism, which in his definition is a principle balancing the sanctity of the individual with the acknowledgement of the interconnectedness of modern society and favoring self-organization over hierarchical control. That's a really interesting feedback there, and thank you, Gary, so much for joining my Patreon and as well as giving me your feedback there, because, you know, this is something I have harped on a lot. And I want to kind of riff on this today, talking, you know, I've talked about mutual aid, you know, in my Substack newsletter, and I've also touched on it here. And, you know, we have to balance this thing of like, yes, we want to protect individual rights, but people are afraid that if there's this weird fear, and I definitely don't agree with it, that if we work together too much or collaborate, that we're somehow giving up individual rights. And I've covered this, you know, I've talked about, well, you know, first of all, I think it's a definitional issue. I think people are kind of approaching the question from the wrong direction. I think individualism and atomization are two different things. And I think collectivism and teamwork are two different things. And we have to be careful not to mistake those and confuse them, because that misleads us. You've undoubtedly heard me say before that if right-wing people or right-leaning people or freedom-minded individualist people, even if they are centrist or center-left, believe it or not, there's some of those that exist. And we're not even talking about the fact that the political spectrums, you know, as we're undergoing this political realignment in the country, we're going to see people who may have technically been left in our old view of the world or even kind of center-left. Those people are going to be jumping to the right. Again, I've mentioned like Tim Pool and Cassandra Fairbanks, who were Bernie supporters and now kind of moved towards the right, or at least kind of Trump-leaning people. And, you know, I've also covered before, like, you know, Bernie Sanders had that 2015 interview that I played in like episode 7 or 8, I think it was, where he's like, open borders? That's like a right-wing position. It's like, no, we need closed borders and we don't need open borders. We need to keep, you know, labor, we need to keep labor out because it drives down labor costs. I mean, it was really fascinating to hear Bernie Sanders, of all people, you know, like advocating a wall in 2015, who's like, you know, no, it's like open borders drives down labor, it wrecks, you know, domestic labor markets. And like, he was basically channeling Trump stuff Trump was saying, and this was like in May 2015, so it was like before Trump joined in. and started running. So it was really fascinating to hear that. But it shouldn't be surprising in that context that we're going to see people who may have once sort of been Bernie-leaning people, you know, jump over towards what's going to be the new right, and some people that were, you know, technically Republican, you know, up to a couple years ago, that they're now going to the Democrats and joining the new left because we're undergoing this big political realignment. Anyway, so yeah, we're gonna talk about, you know, individualism and atomization, teamwork and collectivism, and the differences between this. First off, I don't buy the assertion that right-wing people cannot work together well because, you know, we're individualists and not collectivists. I mean, I think it touches on something that's sort of true, but I think it's fundamentally wrong. And I think it's being used as an excuse. I think it's being used as a crutch. I think people are buying into it, and it's crippling their ability to build teams and build a resilient community, because they assume off the bat, oh, we can't, you know, there's no work. It's not even worth really trying to work together with other people because we're not going to be able to, because right-wing people can't work together. This, folks, this is a toxic mindset. I mean, there's a little bit of truth to it. I'm going to deal with that. But I think overall it's a toxic mindset, and it's a toxic position to hold. And because it keeps you from really trying, and even if you do try, you're undermining yourself because you assume from the beginning we're not going to be able to do it. Folks, lefties infight all the time. Like, they fight a lot. It's crazy how wild they fight and how, you know, intense and bitter their fighting is. So yes, there's tons of fighting on the left too, even with collectivists. Secondly, you know, if individualist people, which, yeah, I mean, right-leaning people tend to be more individual rights oriented. If that was somehow prevented you from working together, or, you know, building a team or collaborating, then the military and law enforcement wouldn't be skewed politically conservative compared to the population. Like, you know, maybe it's changing a little bit in the military, but still, even today, you know, it's fairly well understood that military and law enforcement people, granted, probably in like some very blue areas, you're going to have people that are, you know, even the cops that are to the left of people in red areas, but generally speaking, for their local, you know, for especially law enforcement, they're going to be a little bit more right-leaning than the population that they protect and serve. And the military generally is somewhat more conservative than the population at large. So if it was true that right-wing people could not work together, I don't think you would see that. Like, we all know the military and law enforcement does not draw crazy left-wing radicals. Yeah, they exist, but it's not predominantly staffed by them. So the question is, like, how does, I mean, yeah, it's like the military and law enforcement are not occupations that draw, like, heavily, you know, individualist people that refuse to collaborate with one another. I mean, it is, those are technically sort of collectivist organizations. If you look at them, it's all about subsuming your well-being to a greater cause, you know, like you're choosing a collective cause, a collective well-being of the community, and you're laying yourself out there, putting yourself in danger to protect it. So in any other context, that would be considered collectivism. So the question is, like, how does it happen? So, you know, I think really what you're going to have in that sort of situation is you have to have some sort of transcendental cause that's worth sacrificing for. Like, people you talk to, folks in military and law enforcement, they're Republican type folks, and they're like, I want to be part of something great. It's like, I love this country. It's amazing. I want to protect it. I want to go out there. And then, you know, they're also, after that may be their initial motivation for joining, but a lot of these people, they're like, I want to take care of the people next to me. Like, I love my brothers in arms, and, like, I want to, you know, I fight for them, and it's, I love the community and the teamwork. And yeah, these are people that, you know, generally, you know, would be Republican and, like, or are Republican or are conservative, and they're out there doing something incredibly collectivist. So yeah, it's like, you know, the two big things that I've noticed in this is you have to have, like, some type of explicit cause and something that's worth fighting for, like something you can, like a vision, like what you want. Like, you know, we're doing, it's like, you know, someone says, I'm a police officer because I want to, you know, fight bad guys and I want to keep the community safe. And then they like the people that they're working with, and that keeps them in. And it's sort of the same with the military. The military is like, their objective is to protect the United States of America, and America is an amazing country with lots of amazing, you know, our constitution and our culture and the people and the history. So that it's something that you can express. You have to have something that's, you know, a tangible ideology and a goal that is something that people are attracted to. And then you have to have some type of mechanism that, you know, or some type of organization and mechanism that provides a realistic, you know, chance of accomplishing that goal. It's like, you know, the military, the way it's organized, like we've had, you know, 240 years old in America, like 1776. So it's like, I mean, we've had a military pretty much the whole time. So that's something that's fought in a lot of wars. There's history of war fighting, and people have this tradition and history that goes back a long time. And, you know, there is, whether or not, you know, I mean, China's in the middle of a huge naval buildup, as I discussed, and we have not designed a new warship in like 20, and not designed and built a successful new warship within the last 20 years. Even the Virginia class was first like laid down like before the 21st century, like right at the tail end of the 20th. So that's concerning for me because it's two decades. So yeah, we're not going to get off on that tangent. But yeah, you know, we have this, you know, there's the goal that people have, you know, to protect America or protect the community, and the mechanism via which people have a substantive chance of accomplishing that goal, which is, you know, the military has doctrine and other people and equipment and a plan to do that. So that, I think that's what attracts people. Those are the two big things you need. Got to have a goal. You got to have some type of tangible goal that you can express, and you have to have some realistic chance or mechanism or some plan for accomplishing it or protecting it. Now, this is where I'm going to kind of disagree with a lot of folks on this. This is a very important distinction to make. I think individualism and teamwork versus atomization and collectivism, we have to understand the differences here. Yes, lefties tend to be a little bit more collectivist, but lefties are also a little bit more atomized. I think right-wing people tend to be more individualist, but when you're an individual and you're an individualist type person, you are better able to engage in teamwork, and these are two different things. Teamwork is not collectivism. Atomization is not individualism. Atomization is something that you see in cities a lot. You know, like when I lived in San Francisco, like, it's just, you don't know the people on the street next to you. You feel like you're not part of a community. There's no real, like, you may have friends, but there's no generational community you're part of. Generally speaking, there isn't. I mean, there are some places, like the Mission is very heavily immigrant and Hispanic, and like there are people there I know who have generations in San Francisco, but generally speaking, that's fairly rare. In a city, people are atomized, which is, you're not part of a community, you don't feel connected. The people you bump into on the street, you don't know them, you're probably never going to see them again. And that leads to a situation where, you know, your choices and your behavior doesn't necessarily immediately blow back on you. And there's less of an incentive to try to engage in like positive, you know, like civic behavior. Let me give an example. Like, I'm originally from Mississippi, from rural Mississippi. My county had like 12,000 people in it, total, the whole county. We did not have a single stoplight in the county. Not a single intersection with a stoplight anywhere in the county. There was one McDonald's, and it was attached to a gas station. That's how rural we're talking about. I would occasionally bump into people that I didn't recognize or didn't see. And granted, it was the South, so people, there's a much greater emphasis on being polite and courteous to people. Even if I got angry at someone and wanted to like yell at them or something, or aggravated, I generally didn't do it, because the reality is, there's a lot of times I bumped into someone and I didn't recognize him and had a conversation, maybe introduced myself, and then a couple days later, I would hear from my mom, "Hey, I ran into so-and-so, you know, he said he saw you and chatted and had a good conversation." And so, yeah, you know, I mean, there was that whole point of like, A, I may not recognize this person, but he may have heard of me, or they may know of me, or that we may have a mutual friend somewhere. And, you know, if I show my ass to this person, my mom's going to yell, even as an adult, like it didn't matter, you know, 30 years old or whatever, like my mom's still going to call and yell at me if I'm rude in some fashion, you know. Another thing there is, what if I bump into this person again? Because it happened. There were some people I didn't recognize, and it was weird. It's like I would meet someone in some context that I didn't know, and then, like, say hello, and, like, they were from the area. But then, like, in the next few weeks and months, I would bump into this person into some different places, and it was strange. It was like just the fact of meeting this person created some type of magnetic charge, where over the following weeks and months, we would just run into each other in different places, even if, you know, we were both from the area and just had never actually interacted before. So, yeah, it was like, A, you know, I not show my ass if I'm angry at someone or they're angry at me. It's like we both had an incentive because, you know, what if I hear about it? What if my mom calls and yells at me? You know, that's embarrassing. I don't want to anger my mom, and I don't want her to be embarrassed or angry because she has to deal with some shit that I caused. So, A, my mom would call and yell at me if I did something, or my dad would. My dad would know them, and he would call and yell. So, don't do that, A. Don't embarrass them, because, you know, my family been in the area for 150 years. Don't do that. And then B, it's like, what if I see this person again, and I've already was an asshole to them, or they were an asshole to me, and there's still that tension there. It's like, I don't want to, like, you know, run into this person a few weeks from now and, like, have another conflict because we were dicks to each other. You know, I don't want to do that. There was a big incentive not to do that in rural areas. That's the cultural, like, community context. Some of the things people from big cities may not understand. It's like, you know, even with someone who's notionally a stranger, you don't really want to do it because you want to resolve things, you know, in a polite manner, because if you're in an area that's very rural and low population, that's going to cause you tons of problems down the road. So generally don't do it. A city, you don't really have that. It's like you see people, you don't know them. You're probably never going to never see them again. So yeah, you know, there's, and plus cities are kind of stressful places. There's so many people everywhere, and it's just kind of tense, and you're trying to get around places, and it's a tendency to kind of be an asshole to someone. Like, there's an incentive to be an asshole, and then whatever, they don't know your family. You know, I'm not going to get blowback from it from other people. So it's like, those incentives are not there. And, I mean, it's a very marginal thing. You know, it's not something that, you know, makes a huge difference, but it's a marginal difference. It's like there's little areas where you would get frustrated, and you would, like, in the country or a rural area, you would get frustrated and you would want to say something to someone, and you didn't because of those two factors that I previously mentioned. You know, at least for me, it's like, okay, I want to yell at this person, and I'm not, because A, I'm going to get yelled at by my mom, very likely. B, I'm probably going to see this person again in the future when I'm not angry, and it's going to be awkward. But if those two factors are gone, there's going to be situations where you wouldn't otherwise show your ass, you know, figuratively, and you do because you're in a city. So it makes cities these places where there's a lot of conflict, and that's where the laws come in. That's why you have more laws in the city, is because more people are interacting on a regular basis and they're having more complex interactions. And because of those two factors I mentioned, combined with the fact that there's probably from different cultures, like at least in the country, like in the Delta, it was a fairly diverse area in the sense that we had, like, whites and blacks who had distinctly different cultures. We also had, like, Indians, and there were some Jewish people that lived there, and a lot of Chinese people, Asian people that had, like, a lot of the stores. So there was these subcultures that lived in the area, and they had different cultures, but it was like it was diverse, but it was kind of a specifically narrow window, and you kind of knew, you know, okay, here's, like, the weird little quirks from interacting with these people. And you kind of understood it. There was a language there. But when you go to a city like I love San Francisco. It was a really fun place, and I hate to see what's happening to it. But you go to a city like San Francisco, and people can be from freaking anywhere in the world. And you don't know, even if they do look like you, or you think they're like you, they could be from a wildly different part of America with fundamentally different assumptions for how people interact. So, you know, I've heard culture described as the art of the unspoken assumption. And what happens, what a law really is taking that unspoken assumption and making it explicit because people don't understand it. It's like you have people from different backgrounds who don't have the same sort of assumptions. So the rules have to be codified in a way that everyone can understand. So yeah, you've got, and that's on top of the fact people don't have those incentives to be polite and behave towards each other like they would in a more red rural area. I think fundamentally that's why cities are always going to have more laws than like rural areas. It's because of all those factors. All of those factors that I kind of listed there are things that lead to atomization, which is, you know, what some people would consider individualism, but I don't really think it is. I mean, atomization is the point of like, you don't really have any roots or connections in the area, and you don't really have any connection to the other residents of the area. You're kind of by yourself. You can't, like, you know, if you have a car breakdown, you're not sure someone's going to stop and help you. It's basically low. It's basically the lack of social structure combined with like low social capital. That's atomization. And that's something lefties have. Lefties, in my opinion, are more prone to atomization than righties in rural areas. So you could consider, I don't think it's individualism. Some people may call it that. I don't think it is. If it is, it's not a healthy form of individualism. That's the important thing. Collectivism, on the other hand, I think is what happens when atomization gets out of control. It's like people realize they're missing something. Like being a loner is lonely. I mean, I've traveled the world. I backpack around the world. I spent like 9 months living out of a backpack. And like, I love New Zealand. You know, I really do. It's my favorite, like, my favorite place on earth. It's just gorgeous. The people are so nice. But yeah, I was in the South Island of New Zealand. And I'm kind of an introvert. You know, I just am. It's like an extrovert is someone who gains energy from interacting with other people. So an introvert is someone who, like, expends it while they're interacting with other people. But even I got lonely down there. You know, I was wandering around checking stuff out, and because I'm an introvert, I have a tendency to kind of not interact with people. Like, you just kind of not think about it, and then you realize I've gone, you know, 5 or 6 days without having a conversation with someone in person, and it just got, like, really kind of weird. I was like, I need to talk to people. Like, even I, an introvert, got kind of weirdly lonely. And I made a point after that, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to spend 30 minutes a day. Like, I'm going to go out there and find someone who's open and interesting and friendly and have a really deep conversation with them. And like, cause too, it's like, you want to interact with locals. That's one of the funnest parts of traveling, is interacting with locals. But I do have to constantly remind myself, I have to keep doing this, because if I don't, I will, you know, I will do that again, where I'll spend a week not talking to anyone really, other than like buying food or like buying a ticket to a different place and just walking around the city looking at stuff, and realize like I'm completely, you know, lost touch with it, other human beings. And that gets kind of weirdly, like, I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain. It gets, if you do that sort of thing, it gets on your nerves after a while. It gets kind of grating. So like, and you feel really weird. I know I felt, even an introvert like me, I felt really unmoored. So yeah, you know, I spent 30, 45 minutes, an hour a day, like, I go have a lunch, walk around, sit down, talk to people, ask them questions about the city, have a really interesting conversation. Obviously, my accent wasn't like theirs, so they knew I was a foreigner, and Kiwis are super accommodating and friendly people. So they would have a great conversation with me, and we would have these really interesting conversations, because New Zealand's a country with fairly high social capital. It's not, you know, it's a place with a lot of trust. People are generally really great, and you know, I would have these awesome conversations, and I would get more information about the local community and like places to go check out and things that weren't necessarily on the tourist guide that they would, you know, wouldn't show up or whatever. But like, hey, you need to go check this place out because this is really cool. And when I like to travel a lot, and when I like to travel, I like to kind of meet with locals. Like, I'd rather spend time with locals. Like, I'll go check out like 1 or 2 days for, you know, the tourist stuff, but then the rest of my trip, I'll go visit the locals and hang out in the local places, because that's what being a local, that's what being a tourist, in my opinion, should be. Is like, I want to go meet the local people, see how they live, and like really embed myself in that, and not just be a tourist. Anyway, that's what atomization is, and that's why it's bad. I get off on those little tangents. I hope you find them entertaining. Sorry, I have a multi-track drifting mind. So anyway, so yeah. That sort of leads people, you know, when you're like that, you want to start you want to feel community again. Because like I said, even for an introvert like me, I was like, fuck, I don't want to be alone all the time. This is really uncomfortable. So you have these lefties who a lot of times in the cities, they're people that have some, you know, they're kind of weird and weird people and that are disconnected in some fashion. And they morph into this thing called collectivism, which is, you know, what happens when atomized people try to get together. It's like they want to, they think that is what teamwork is or what a community feels like. It's just subsuming your qualities as an individual into this greater collective. So I think that's really what where the confusion comes in. It's like collectivism is like where you don't have any real agency, and some of the worst toxic aspects of humanity come out. Because I've seen this a lot, you know, living in San Francisco, I went to a lot of different areas. San Francisco is a very left city. And I went to a lot of, you know, nightlife scenes that were extremely lefty spaces. And, you know, I wasn't running around Trump gear or anything. But, you know, I would just go hang out there. And it was interesting because a lot of these people had very toxic ways of interacting with one another and as a group. And, you know, once you're atomized, you don't have these healthy ways of interacting with other people. So when you get a bunch of people who don't have healthy ways of interacting together in a collectivist sense, that it makes a very toxic stew. And that's really what you see on the left, is like they're actually weirdly more individualistic in a way that's, you know, bad. It is not a positive form of individualism. It's atomization. People that are individuals and they're separated and isolated and don't have community connections and healthy ways of interacting. And then you combine all those people together, you get collectivism, which is a situation where they don't have proper boundaries and they're not, all these toxic aspects come to the fore. There's no dampening effect like you get with a healthy, resilient community. And that's what this collectivism is. And that's, again, that's why lefties infight so much. Again, like you won't believe it until you actually see it. They infight like crazy. They fight so bad. Some of that is because they don't, it's not necessarily teamwork that keeps them together. It's the fact that they just, a lot of them really are very unhealthy and they're very codependent. So instead of like leaving a situation that's toxic, a group situation that's toxic for them, because they don't have good boundaries and they don't have healthy, like, individual, like, respect for themselves, that they will stick in those situations. So it's not so much that, you know, the collectivism and the way that they keep moving in a certain direction. Like, again, they have very toxic, very overpowering ideology in Marxism and a lot of their hard left anarcho-communist beliefs, because these are, you know, tend to be very toxic and defective people in a lot of ways. They hold on to that stuff, whether it's anarcho-communism or Marxism or whatever, Maoism or whatever ideology they're on, that becomes a religion, and they hold on to that because these people don't have like a strong community. They don't have strong personal boundaries. They have to have something greater than themselves, and I think this is a very human instinct. And I think the reason that they're so adamant about working together and are so accomplished so much is, ironically, because of the fact that they're so toxic that they're obsessive about imposing their ideology on the world. And so I think that's the dynamic that I have personally witnessed. It's like they are strangely more individualistic in a very toxic fashion. They also work together in a very collectivist fashion, but their type of collectivism only happens because they're so toxically individualistic that there's no good boundaries, that there's no self-respect for themselves as a person, or no understanding of a healthy community, which balances, you know, community, health and resiliency and individualism. Like Gary mentioned, you know, his connectivism. You have to have sanctity of the individual, understanding that society is interconnected and reinforcing. Now let's talk about individualism and teamwork, which is kind of the mirror image of atomization and collectivism, which are the leftist traits. Individualism and teamwork are the righty traits. The individualism, you know, at first glance may seem like atomization. I don't think it is. I think there is a tendency today that some righties are getting so focused on individualism that it does become a form of atomization. And we need to be very careful about that. Because when righties, because of the differences, you know, lefties tend to live in cities or dense areas. Right-leaning people tend to live in more rural or suburban areas. If righties become atomized, like lefties, when they become atomized, there's always there's basically an assurity that they can become some type of collective. Like there's all those lefty spaces for interactions with people. Righties don't really have that. When you live in a more rural area, there's less interactions with other people, which is going to encourage some individualism. But if it becomes atomization, which is that toxic form of individualism I talked about, there's less chance of forming some type of teamwork or collectivism just because of the geospatial area. It's like the network effects of living in a high population area don't apply to righties. So that's what you have to be careful about. You have to be, you want to focus on individualism, but you don't want to fall into atomization because if you become atomized like lefties, at least lefties can work together in as a collective simply because of the geospatial part of living in high density. Righties don't have that advantage. Individualism, in my opinion, is having individual autonomy that is within a resilient community that involves reciprocal obligations with other individuals. It's where you can do what you want, but you have resilient connections with other healthy people, and that becomes sort of a binding constraint on you because you're like, yes, I can do what I want, but my other friends around me can do what they want. And because we have this reciprocal obligation of behavior and we like and love and respect one another, and there's that inner circle, and then those people that you're connected to have other connections. It kind of creates a web of connections. And if they're generally healthy people, yeah, it's like it's a very gentle, soft kind of restraint. It's like you don't, I can't really say it's restraint because you're not being restrained because you can still do what you want, but you're making decisions to limit your own autonomy. Or I can't say you're not limiting your autonomy. You're limiting what you do because of the feelings that you have towards other people, and they're doing the same to you. It's like, there's things I can do, but I'm not going to do those because I like and respect these other people around you, whether if it's just, like I mentioned before, in the rural, like in Mississippi, I wouldn't be an asshole to people because I didn't know if I'd run into them again, and that's awkward when you have a big blow up with someone and it's unresolved and you keep bumping into them in different places, like a country club or a bar or something like that. It's just really awkward. It's better to try to handle that stuff because it's a pain in the ass when you're always bumping into someone you hate and there's issues that you have not resolved, or you're getting yelled at by your parents. That's what individualism is. It's like I could do what I wanted, but because of my concern for other people and my desire to have something of a healthy community where I'm not hounded by enemies everywhere I go, or I'm going to try to do it. I'm going to moderate myself volitionally on my decision that I'm going to limit what I do in certain ways. That's what you don't get in atomization. You get in things where people, that's why San Francisco, the streets are covered in poop. That's why people do drugs everywhere. It's like, it's why it's a shithole. It's because there's no, people in San Francisco are atomized. There's not a healthy community there. People feel there's no limiting principle. Individualism is basically when you have autonomy with limiting principle, where it's someone who's like more internally limiting principle. Atomization requires an external locus of control, whether like law enforcement or just people kicking your ass when someone really crosses some line. Individualism is something where the limiting principle is like an internal locus of control. Like I want, to behave a certain way, so I'm going to limit the things that I do because this is part of the community I want to live in. And that leads to teamwork. That's where teamwork comes from. It's where people that are autonomous and individuals and respect one another work together for their greater good. And yeah, there's a you can be an individual and believe in greater good. I mean, that again, that's why the military exists. That's why law enforcement exists. That's why those career paths tend to be more conservative, is because it's people who are right-leaning, who are individualists, and are making a choice to engage in teamwork because they have made that choice. That's an internal locus of control for them, part of their value system. that isn't collectivist. That's still that in a real sense, that is what individualism looks like. People saying, I want the world to be a better place. You know, I'm going to limit my, you know, volition. I'm going to dedicate myself to this cause. And that's a healthy process, and society needs that. Another thing about collectivism and, you know, atomization, individualism and, you know, teamwork, like, I feel like personally, at an individual level, if you're like in a red area, or if you're like in a more rural, like flyover state area, you know, I feel like people are more likely to stop and help you. I'm here in Arizona now, and I mean, it went slightly blue, like it just barely went blue in the last election, but this is still a fairly red leaning state. It's not MAGA Republican. This is a kind of a libertarian Republican type, center left state. Yeah, I had a tire blowout a couple of days ago, and like I had to pull over, and I didn't even like I'd pop the trunk, and I pulled over like there was a business there, and it was a great place to have a blowout because I was able to pull well off the road, and like they immediately came out, like they live right by there, and they say, hey, how's it going? I see your tire. Let's help you, you know, and like they didn't even let me change my own tire. It's like a guy came out, like he had a jack, and like he had it done in 2 minutes. Like I didn't even really get a chance. Like I was just popping the trunk, and it's like, hey, I've got it. Don't worry about it. I mean, yeah, that's something that you see happen a lot in red states. And the understanding people have individualism, or what they call individualism, or they tend to mistake for individualism, that wouldn't happen. And that's because, you know, good individualism, like I said, involves reciprocal obligations. People want to help one another. They want to have a resilient community, because honestly, a healthy community is what protects individual rights. You know, you want to have a healthy collective, and that give a healthy collective with high social trust and healthy reciprocal obligations. Excuse me. And that's where, you know, individual rights come. It's like that is where the surplus individual rights happen, because there's a surplus of social capital. You know, if you don't have that, that's when you get atomization and then collectivism. Like in a city, like, I mean, San Francisco is a place where it's anarcho-tyranny. It's like there was a lot of laws, but the laws were not evenly enforced, and there was not cops would try to avoid fucking with people. So you could actually get away with a lot of shit in San Francisco, depending on what you were doing, if you knew how to do it. But that's not healthy either. You know, that's not a healthy type of situation either. So here's an example. How many times have you ever stopped at a car wreck or a car accident? I mean, you may have been in a wreck. People may have stopped for you, but, you know, how many times have you, like, I know I've personally been the first or second person to the scene in two different car wrecks. And one of the wrecks, the guy's legs were all smashed up. The second one, the guy wasn't injured. He laid his bike down, and he wasn't injured that bad. Like, he didn't have any obvious injuries, but, you know, he was obviously, he's, you know, had a helmet and leathers, and he fell down, then flew off in the ditch, and he was, you know, kind of out of it. He was kind of in pain and shocked, but he didn't have any apparent injuries. He was breathing fine. You know, the ambulance came. I never got the final word on that one. The guy that had his legs all smashed up, I helped load him in the ambulance. But yeah, you know, those sorts of things, they happen, you know, and if you live in, you know, people will stop everywhere, but especially in a red area, they're going to stop you, and that's the type of reciprocal obligation that happens when, you know, you have high social capital that allows individualism and people to pursue their own, you know, desires. Speaking of this, you know, one of the local affinity groups I'm involved with, this is a Republican, you know, group. This is a conservative group of people, organized a group buy for Stop the Bleed kits, and had a private training. It was an organized group buy and a training class for over 20 people, this past weekend. And so there was these really nice kits. They also organized, for people who didn't have radios, they organized a Baofeng radio group buy. and they also had the radios programmed. So when you showed up, and you already have radios, but for people who didn't showed up, they had the radios programmed for the channels that they're going to use and other channels. So those were all programmed. The group buy kits were the bleeding control kits were distributed. They had a big training class on how to use that, how to like do stop the bleed, but you know, wound control, tourniquets, pressure and chest. There was even like, they didn't do the needles, but they actually showed how to build a how to do a chest seal, how to apply that. And it was a really great class. And something else that was cool is I had to take my dog because of logistical complications. And she's a great girl. She's about 8 months old. She's really sweet, about 40 pounds. She's a black mouth cur. Her name's Ellie. And so I had to take her because of logistical complications. And the people teaching the class are actually setting up a canine. They're in the process of finishing their canine first aid class. So they tacked on a canine trauma module at the end of the class for everyone. And it turned out to be really great because, you know, we got to do stop the bleed on people, learn how to do that. We got our kits, people got radios. And then we also got taught how to do first aid on dogs, which is something, you know, it's trickier than, I mean, it's obviously much less popular than first aid for people, but it was really interesting to have that opportunity to learn how to do first aid on my dog. It's like we did tourniquets on her. You can't do regular like cat or soft TY tourniquets on a dog. It's just that their limbs are too small. Like maybe their back legs you can, depending on the location. They were showing us ways to use like a SWAT T, which is the rubber band tourniquet. It's not really, SWAT T's are kind of, they're not the best for tourniquets. They're not the optimal choice. They're better than nothing, but there's better choices. They're better than a rat's, but that's not saying much. There's better choices for a tourniquet. SWAT T's have some interesting uses as far as pressure bandages and chest seals. But actually SWAT T's work pretty good on kids and dogs. It's like they're showing how to apply it to a dog. And a SWAT T is a great tourniquet for a dog. We also practiced applying a chest seal to her. So if she ever gets injured and has like, you know, a punctured lung or something, or pneumothorax, we can fix that. So it was a pretty good trauma module that built on what we had just learned in Stop the Bleed class. And that's a local, you know, Republican affinity group, conservative gun people affinity group. And they're putting stuff like that on. You know, that's not collectivism. I mean, that's teamwork. And that's what teamwork looks like. Righties, and that's one big thing I've had to learn, is like, you know, we just kind of assume that it's very easy at the top line level to look and think, hey, righties are individualists and can't work together. Lefties are collectivists and work together. And like I've explained, my personal opinion for having dove into everything, having seen the lefties up close and why they are the way they are, and the way righties are and the way they are, I don't think it's true. Righties are perfectly capable of really effective, awesome teamwork. There's also, like I mentioned in my recent Substack, there is the Cajun Navy, which is basically that, you know, ad hoc group of people across the South who own boats, who's whenever a hurricane or a natural disaster happens, they travel to the area, deploy their boats, and go rescue people. That's, you know, generally a right-leaning type of thing. The people in that group, obviously it's not explicitly partisan, but the people who do that sort of thing are going to lean more to the right. So that's another thing. That's community care and, you know, taking care of each other. So the capability is there for right-wing people to work together, and we have seen it. I'm seeing it now. I mean, we just had that group I mentioned last weekend. Group buy for Stop the Bleed kits, radios, dog, you know, training class, trauma dog kit. You know, it's just, that's a group, a sizable group of explicitly politically Republican people that are working together. And they're going to start working on some local political causes as well. So I know that's not an excuse. You know, I know for a fact that righties and Republicans are capable of working together and networking just as good or even more effectively than lefties are. They just have to understand, like, the patterns and the networks already exist on the right. We just have to learn to recognize them and apply them in our own way. I think it's important that we start doing this. I'm going to start wrapping this up here. not going to have it run too long. It's important that we start recognizing this and working together with these teamwork programs, these tribes, these freedom cells. Like, that's one good name I've heard for this. You know, like I mentioned, affinity group is what lefties call them. It's a little weird term. I think it's a little strange. Like, lefties come up with weird names for stuff. We need to find our own little terms for them that better fit us. And, like, a freedom cell, I think, is actually a pretty good one. But I was calling them tribes. Tribes, freedom cells, whatever you want to call it, affinity groups. Like, we already have these, and we need to start explicitly working on these. And we have to understand, we already have the capability. We already have people doing this stuff. We have to be very conscious of it. Because what's happening now, I have talked in my Substack about the Mutual Aid, the last Substack I had. The newsletter, Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. The mutual aid thing that's happening in Texas. These lefties have these mutual aid groups, and they're sending them down to Texas and pumping money into them and helping people. And again, that's a PR campaign, but they're also doing stuff like the occupation, hotel occupation stuff that I've written about. They're putting people in hotels, and they're setting up. It looks like they're going to start doing hotel. I would not be surprised if they start doing the hotel occupation stuff in Texas as well. Like that sort of thing, you know, there's something lefties call dual power, which is they're trying to create a shadow government that, as they're undermining the legacy government, the local government, they're creating shadow institutions that build capacity and organize and network. And that's really what's happening in Texas. And this is something that's happening really across the country. It's like they're building these alternative institutions as they erode the legacy institutions, and these alternative institutions start to grow more influential, and they are building goodwill. And another thing to remember too is, like, everything that you see, like all the anarchist stuff that I saw in Portland, all of that shit, the mutual aid stuff, is mutual aid is basically when it's a logistical act. It's like when people are gathering funds, gathering equipment and other supplies and distributing them however they need. This is what you have to understand. It's the same reason they use the U.S. military to deploy disaster supplies, is because the U.S. military has a massive logistical capability, and that logistical capability that you use in wartime can be easily deployed towards peacetime. And that's basically what the lefties are doing with mutual aid. Everything that I saw in Portland, like, you know, all the supplies that kept the nightly riots going and the riots that are still going on, all that stuff comes from mutual aid. All the shields that they built, mutual aid societies gathered the raw materials for that. Mutual aid groups are a logistical network that can feed an army. And lefties are building that right now. And they're using those mutual aid societies to build an alternative network to help local communities, to get the local community on their side as they undermine local governments. And I think that's really a really important thing that you have to take away from that, is if you don't feel like if government, as government capacity falls off, as we're not at a failed state quite yet, but we are at a hollow state where the government is just less and less able to respond to daily needs. If we don't start stepping in and start, you know, doing what we can to change that, the lefties are going to do that. And because if the lefties are the people who keep showing up and helping people and changing things, then they're going to be the ones that, you know, people are going to start following. And we shouldn't be surprised that there's a leftward shift in the country. And it's for a lot of reasons. One of the big reasons is that. So I'm going to wrap this up here. I'm actually going to link in the description Center for Security Policy, Kyle Schidler wrote a piece that just came out today about the Antifa-aligned mutual aid groups that are happening in Texas. It's a pretty good piece. I'm actually quoted in it and referenced in it in several places. So, you know, rah, rah, go me. But it's a really good piece. Definitely read it. It's a really good overview of a lot of stuff that I was talking about with mutual aid. Anyway, I'll have some more stuff out for you later today. I hope you're having a good one. Take care. And again, Gary, thank you so much and for joining my Patreon. And thank you for your feedback. It gave me a really great topic to riff on here. Y'all have a great one, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.